Welcome to season two of The Political Nomad. It has been, 2 years since I've done something like this? And when I did this originally, I was getting stories. I wanted to get stories of people because it was the stories that were important to me. It was the stories that could tell us who we are as people, where we've been politically, because not every person's story is the same. This season, we're going to be talking about issues. And I brought my good friend, Jacob Perry, back onto the show, which I'm sure Jacob would be the first to tell you that even to this day, his two episodes are still the most listened to episodes of The Political Nomad season one. that's no joke, because Stuart Stevens was my last guest and you still top Stuart. So
I'm going to tell him he said that.
It's what the stats bear. Anyway, so I'm back doing this after a couple of years. Primarily, you know, there are personal reasons why I haven't been able to do it. We moved, things changed. I honestly just didn't have the capacity or the space to do this. But now things are kind of slowing down. Other things are picking up, but I'm back and I'm doing this. And the reason I have Jacob on, not because he was my most popular guest before, but because also he is a friend. He and I can talk politics, honestly, until 2 a.m, without a breath. And
I think we probably have.
Yeah, we probably have, but we don't have that kind of time tonight. So we're recording this as President Biden is giving his State of the Union address. So neither of us, maybe he started. I'm sure the applause have died down at some point. None of us are seeing this. We'll have our cold freezing takes tonight on it. And so when people finally hear this, they'll be like, wow, they were either really wrong or they were like so incredibly wrong that they should not have even aired this show. And so I'm going to go for it.
Could end up being the case anyway.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So first of all, Jacob, it's been a while. What have you been up to that you can tell us? Do we have any more of the Burt Reynolds story that you haven't shared? Because that story is legendary, and I'd be remiss if I didn't bring it up. And I guess
I still don't know who the young lady in the picture is.
Oh, that's gonna be the mystery that eludes us. So okay, the top story outside of the State of the Union, we'll get to the State of the Union, but obviously, and I want to talk about issues this season, but I don't think we can start the season off without talking about what's going on in Russia. And with the way that Putin has, we knew he was going to do this. Honestly, we've known for years that he was going to do this. Zelensky has been begging to get into the EU, which if anything strengthened Putin's fervor to try to do this sooner. I mean, that's why he took Crimea. And that was after his sort of puppet president was overthrown in 2014. Not puppet president, but, you know, the guy was definitely in Putin's pocket. So I guess we're almost a week into World War III. What do you make of the president's response so far? And would you have done anything differently?
Well, you start off with the good stuff tonight.
I do. It's been so long. It's like it's all pent up. I have to just get it out.
Yeah. I've been fine with the president's response, to be honest with you. And, you know, listen, for a 132-year-old man, he's doing a hell of a good job. Mm-hmm. And so you got to give him credit for, I mean, if I was 132, I'd be dead probably. Right. So he's certainly energetic. And, you know, I can hear the applause in the other room.
Yeah.
You know, I do think there's something to be said for having a president who chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for like a decade or more.
Yeah.
That has to come in handy as far as, you know, knowledge of the world, you know, actually knowing where Ukraine is, which is an improvement over his predecessor. And so I don't really have any issues at the moment. I'm hearing a lot of stuff about, you know, there should be no, you know, we should be enforcing a no-fly zone. You know, we should be sending stuff over. And, like, I hear that. But the problem you end up with something like that is, okay, so if it's American fighter planes enforcing a no-fly zone or UN fighter planes enforcing a no-fly zone and the Russians shoot back, well, then what do you do? Like, you literally now just have a shooting war. Mm-hmm. You know, we are now literally at war with Russia. Mm-hmm. And so I get all the hawks and I get all the, oh, we got to send everything over there. We got to do everything we can to help them. Listen, I respect all of that. But there's a fine line between, you know, the sanctions and what I believe the electronic countermeasures and the cyber warfare and things that, clearly are being done. You know, American corporations are stepping up. You see, you know, Boeing just announced about an hour ago that they're completely withdrawing from Russia entirely. You know,
really?
They're not supporting any Russian aircraft. They're removing their maintenance teams and their support teams. You know, that's really what should be done. There should be economic sanctions. And here's the other part of this. There should be economic sanctions against all of the oligarchs, because those guys are Putin's power base. Like, basically, for people who don't really understand, and I don't pretend that I understand completely, but when Putin came to power, essentially what he did was help give major chunks of the Russian economy over to these politicians. You know, it'd be like if Trump had gotten in the office and given Matt Gaetz, you know, FP&L in Florida, Florida Power and Light, their state utility.
Yeah.
You know, that's essentially what Putin did. And so he took all these guys who were lower and mid-level state politicians and army generals, and whatever, and divvied out, you know, major chunks of the economy to them and made them all billionaires. So the flip side of that is, that's all those guys care about, is their, you know, their fourth apartment down in Miami, or the yacht anchored off of Malta, or, you know, sending their kids to private school in London. Cut all that off. You know, then let's see what happens. And I think you're starting to see some of that happening now, where there's going to be long-term ramifications, because the only way you're going to take down someone like that is eliminate his power base completely.
Yeah.
It's not going to war. It's not nuking him. It's not, you know, any of that kind of stuff. It's what all can we do in 2021 to cut the guy off at the knees without actually getting the shooting ball?
And that's what's honestly kind of surprised me so far. I mean, when I saw the president's press conference last week and he was talking about doing the extreme sanctions, and I'll always put them in quotes because, I mean, that's kind of how he expressed it. And it's like, oh, as opposed to the super duper light sanctions that we've been doing previously. And I mean, I'm sorry. Every time I think of sanctions, I think of Iran and their nuclear program, and it's like a lot of good that's done. Or Korea and North Korea and their nuclear program, and like a lot of good that's done. I mean, you think of sanction, it's like you're not hurting the government, you're hurting the people. And yes, you are seeing people making runs at the banks, but what I see is it's actually working. And I'll admit that maybe I got ahead of myself, but it does seem like they worked. And I will also admit that I was a bit of a hawk. I didn't necessarily want to see Biden sending in troops, but I wanted to see more than just, oh, we're going to, you know, cut him off from his bank. Like, oh yeah, you don't think he hasn't planned for that? But it does seem like it is having an effect. You certainly are seeing Putin's people, like the Russian people, aren't buying what Putin's selling here. And I think that's key here. Yes, they're being affected. They're the ones who are mostly being affected, but I think to a certain degree, they're starting to understand why. And it isn't because of the United States or isn't because of the EU. It's because of Putin. And
you know, I'm going to circle back onto something you just said a minute ago. You talked about sanctions against Iran and North Korea, and maybe it's Cuba in there, or maybe I just made that up. But, you know, the difference between those, you know, sanction efforts is that Russia, for the most part, is a relatively modern economy that interacts with pretty much every nation on the planet. You know, North Korea trades with China. Mm-hmm. And China.
Yeah.
You know, Cuba trades with like five countries. You know, Iran trades with like a dozen countries. And so, you know, those other countries have reasons to prop up those states. You know, nations have a vested interest in propping up Iran. Nations have a vested interest in propping up North Korea. But it seems like you have just about the world. You know, it reminds me of the great Norm Macdonald joke of, you know, Hitler picking fights against the world. You know, with the world. It's a great thing.
Rest in peace, Norm Macdonald.
My head as we were saying that. But that's kind of what's happening is pretty much everyone, including the Germans, and for while we're at it, the Swiss have even jumped in.
Right?
Sweden. And like all these countries that are going, yo, you know, we have an effective way. You know, here's the thing. The free traders have won here, right? Mm-hmm. The free traders have kind of won because the argument that we've always made is when all these economies are interconnected, no one has a vested interest in war. And I think we're kind of seeing it where Russia's economy is just got sent back to the third world in a matter of a week.
Yeah.
Like in a matter of a week, they're basically Ethiopia at this point, right? Mm-hmm. They're Ethiopia with nukes and gas. And that's about it, right? And a whole bunch of parked Mercedes, SUVs and, you know, empty Prada stores and stuff in Moscow. That's really it. So we kind of have won this argument. You could say we've maybe lost a few other arguments, but we certainly won this one because that was one of the major bases around that argument is free trade promotes peace. And so Putin, a cold warrior who comes from, you know, the communist era, doesn't know a damn thing about free trade. So it's not something that it's not a language that he necessarily speaks. Yeah. Whereas these more modern leaders are like, hey, did y'all see what happened to Russia? Like, maybe we don't want to invade, you know, XYZ country.
Yeah.
You know, because at this point, the only warfare you're seeing around the world is from third world countries. Mm-hmm. It's not from modern nations. It's not from nations that trade and exchange ideas and promote each other's ideas. It's these third world countries who literally have nothing else to lose.
Well, it seems as if the more modern warfare that goes on between developed nations is more of the cyber wars and the propaganda machines that are propped up by social media. Not that I want to get on a rant on social media, but I mean, clearly they have an outlet there. I think it's interesting in light of everything that you're saying here, because the Boeing thing really kind of takes me by surprise. Because, you know, when you look at war, heck, when you look at World War II, you know, yes, the world was at war. Germany went to war with the world. Yeah. But the fact is that you still had American manufacturers supplying arms and vehicles to the Nazis. You know, in all the wars, you have American manufacturers supplying arms and vehicles and stuff like that to somebody. And so it's like, oh man, yeah, the economy is going to go to crap, but the defense people, like, you know, Northrop Grumman and Boeing and stuff like that, they're going to make money hand over fist. And so to hear, and I mean, shoot, their stocks shot up, you know, like as soon as Russia invaded, defense stocks shoot up, which is to be expected, honestly, but It just kind of struck me as funny. You looked at me inquisitively when I said that we had American manufacturers supplying stuff to the Nazis.
I mean, sort of, yeah. It's
the Ford Motor Company?
Yeah, but that was a foreign subsidiary operating under license. I mean, it wasn't you know, Henry Ford wasn't pocketing, you know.
Okay.
I mean, trust me, he'd have been happy to, right? I mean,
oh, sure.
Down to taking money to get rid of the Jews, Henry Ford would have been all for it. So, like, I'm not exactly... I'm not here to defend Henry Ford, but it was a little, you know, a lot of those companies, you're right to an extent, and I'm not like pushing back, but
No, but I'm glad to get some context.
Foreign companies who had subsidiaries in Germany and in Europe, they'd been doing business there for 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
No, that makes sense. And it's good to supply that context to that comment. So I watched this video last night, and I posted it to the Political Nomad channels. It's by a YouTube channel called Real Life Lore. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But this, the guy who runs the channel, he did basically a breakdown of why, and this was 2 days ago that he posted this, but why Russia invaded Ukraine. And outside of the sort of the obvious, he goes into a lot of the history and the topography and the geography of why Putin would do this. So, I mean, but basically what it came down to was Russia hates NATO. all the Eastern Bloc countries that were their buffer versus NATO are now in the EU or on the verge of being in the EU. And that is a threat, direct threat to Moscow. And there is that great European plane, you know, like from Finland to the Urals, that is just basically open season for anybody who wanted to invade, which made it, which is why it was easy for Hitler and Napoleon to just march on in. And so a lot of people, I don't think, understand the history there. And the fact that there were sanctions on the pipelines and how Ukraine was making money off of Russia going, taking their pipelines through Ukraine. And so that's why you had the Russian to Germany pipeline, like the direct one. Because Russia was trying to basically circumvent everybody so that they wouldn't have to worry about, NATO. I mean, they were basically trying to take care of themselves. And so I guess if you kind of understand the Russian history a bit, so this isn't just Putin. This is just, and it's not blaming the Russian people, but I mean, it seems as if those in charge in Russia have always been leery of invaders. And even though NATO or the EU have never given the impression that they would be the ones invading Russia, especially as you've said, you know, they've essentially become a first world market in the marketplace. What would be the point of invading Russia? But to get Ukraine, especially after, was it Poroshenko? Was that the name of the previous guy? When Poroshenko lost or was overthrown, and that was Putin's guy, then he got really freaked out and he took Crimea, which was the port, you know, and it's still, and all the gas, the natural gas, there's apparently the second largest natural gas store is in that area right by Crimea outside of Russia, because Russia has the largest. And so by taking Crimea, Russia simply just took 2/3 of that natural gas well. And there are two large natural gas pockets, one on the east end and one on the west end of Ukraine. And if you look at where the two states that Putin recognized as being separatist states towards Russia, those are directly like over that eastern well. And that there's that section on the west end, just kind of southwest Ukraine, that's just south of the other well or pocket, large pocket of natural gas. That, so I mean, Putin was looking to take out Ukraine as an energy supplier because Ukraine was a poor, poor country until they realized, holy crap, we have all this natural gas. And so, I mean, they were making billions off of Russia first for just trying to get the pipelines through Ukraine. But now that that's not an issue for Russia, or they're trying not to make it an issue, now they just want the energy. And they want to use Ukraine as a buffer because Ukraine is the largest piece left because Belarus is part of the CSTO. They're not going to be part of the EU. And Armenia is the other part of the CSTO, which is basically Russia's version of NATO. And mind you, I'm just regurgitating what I saw in this video last night, but it was a half hour long and it was absolutely fascinating. And the context that it's supplied to what is going on here was really kind of eye-opening, honestly. And so fortunately, I don't think I've heard too much of Republicans or Democrats, at least elected leaders, blaming Biden for Putin invading Russia or invading Ukraine. There have been some.
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's been a couple of the wackos, but it's not really been mainstream thought. But I don't know what mainstream thought the Republican Party is anymore.
Yes. And I'm actually going to use that as a good segue. I'm going to use that as a segue because I feel like there's only so much we could talk about Ukraine and Russia because it is certainly an ongoing situation. And even as we record this, who the heck knows what could happen. Between sure. now and I hope to get this live tomorrow, which would be March 2nd. But again, you don't know what could happen between now and the time that this thing goes live to everybody else. Mainstream Republican thought has, and again, I launched this podcast, as I've said a couple times, to kind of explore my own political deconstruction through other people's stories and hear about their political deconstruction. And that was a big part of your story. You're one of the few people who I feel like has touched base on all the major parties. And still kind of comes away thinking that there are some viable people on both sides, but most everybody sucks. And I think that's maybe a fair assessment. You know, there are some good people on both sides. I want to make that. Does that come across now that I say that? That kind of reminds me of the line that that Trump used when he was talking about the Tiki Torch guys. He's like, there were some good people in there. Like, no, there were. Let's please stop. But I digress. You have like the Liz Cheney's and the Adam Kinzinger's, the Mitt Romney's, and the Republican Party, but they're no longer mainstream thought.
Nope.
What happened? I mean, and if you could take a 10, I know, do we have time for this? If you could summarize. Oh, what do you got? What are you drinking tonight? That's important. Early Times. Nice. Early Times bought bourbon whiskey. 100 proof. My man.
It's the good stuff, man. My man. So, trying to think of a really good place to start. I think the good place to start is the Tea Party, right? I think most of us recognize the Tea Party is the birthplace of Trumpism, which is what the Republican Party is now. It's Trumpism. Mm-hmm. It's not conservatism. It's not, you know, there's not even the mainstream Republicans anymore. It's Trumpism. Mm-hmm. It's we hate brown people. We hate gay people. We hate, you know, doing business with anybody overseas. You know, we hate pretty much everything. Everything scares us. We, the world's big and scary. Mm-hmm. And I do think a lot of it started with the Tea Party, right? And I was always a pretty vocal opponent of the Tea Party, partially because, and we talked about this last time, partially because emotion in politics scares me. I think emotion in politics leads to demagoguery, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, right? That's not a right-wing thing, because it's the AOCs and the squads and, you know, whatever clowns are giving their response to their own president, State of the Union tonight, you know, that's emotionally driven. And emotion drives out logic by its very nature. And I understand, I guess, sort of the role of emotion in politics. And I don't really want to go down that road too far. But I do think that emotion crowds out logic. Mm-hmm. And the Tea Party was all about emotion. It was all about, we're all pissed off. The black man is in power. You know, he may fix things. And we can't have the black man go fixing things. And we're going to cut all the taxes and we're going to, I don't know. I don't even know if anybody can sit here and give you, you know, 13, 14 years later, you know, a coherent description of what the Tea Party was, except it basically was anti-Obama. If we're just being really honest, that's what it was. Right. And you may recognize a theme here as we go along. And so all the crazy actors, including people you and I know, people you and I have worked with, people you and I have worked for, you know, people you and I have known on the national stage and the local stage in Indiana, they're all Trumpers. Like all the big Tea Party leaders that were all spearheading the movement, they're all 100% Trumpers. There's no separation whatsoever. And so they've gone from limited government and let's cut taxes and, well, we hate black people. I still hate black people. So I guess
that's
yeah, I guess that really hasn't changed, right? Because I'm sure if you know Hillary had won the nomination in 2008, the Tea Party would have come around.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah.
We'll discuss that another time. Anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So I do think that was the genesis of it, right? And so then those same people got into the whole, you know, the media is lying to you. You know, the liberal media, right? How many times did you and I talk about that back in the day? Like, all these clowns, the liberal media, they hate you. They're against us. They're the elites. You know,
but the whole distrust of the media goes as far back as, at the very least, the 90s, early 90s.
Dude, it goes back to Watergate and Vietnam. And, I mean, you probably could go even further if you wanted to. Like,
oh, sure, I mean, yeah.
you talk to anybody from the Vietnam era, they will tell you, oh, you know, the media wasn't reporting the real story, and, you know, they weren't reporting the accurate number of deaths, and they weren't right. Let's just go on and on and on. You could go to
I feel like I've heard that same argument over COVID.
Ooh, well, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And so I do think that's what happened is, and then the reality is, when you place your loyalty in a political party first, ahead of loyalty to yourself, your values, your family, your upbringing, your personal character, when all of those things are second behind loyalty to a political organization. And listen, political parties, and you know this as well as I do, they're just a vehicle to get people elected. You know, the fact that people invest so much emotion and energy and time and talent and resource into projecting their ideological viewpoint and attaching it to a particular political party is kind of why we're here. Because you and I are old, I'm older than you, but you're just old enough to remember a time when you had liberals in the Republican Party. You had conservatives in the Democratic
Party. Mitt Romney was considered a liberal.
Oh, right. By the Tea Party people who, you know, hate black people. So
I'm talking about when he was governor.
That again?
I was talking about when he was governor of Massachusetts.
Yeah, because he, God forbid, he tried to come in and put forth a plan to deal with the healthcare crisis.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying it's like interesting.
God forbid.
Well, I mean, you know, yes, but it's like you had the, I guess to go even a little bit further, like you had the Nelson Rockefellers, the Northeast right. Republicans who
correct.
Really all they cared about was their pocketbook.
Sure. And, they were the big business guys. They were the corporate guys. They were 100%. But that's when conventions were literally an ideological battle between the wings.
Mm-hmm.
There are no more ideological battles anymore. It's the Republicans are basically all Trumpists, and Democrats, for the most part, are all left-wing liberals. And so there's really not much of an ideological struggle anymore.
You know, you bring up a good point here, and I want to be fair and kind of get your quick breakdown of the Democrats. But I feel like you don't hear the term wing of the party
correct.
Anymore. It's just correct. The party. And so it's like the extreme elements of the party now are the description of the party. Because they seem to be making up, at least with the Republicans, most of the party. The ones who seem to be getting a lot of the face time on the Democrat side, outside of leadership, and in that case, it's just Nancy Pelosi, are people like the Squad, who are, again considered extreme. And so people will always point to the Squad as, you know, that's the Democrat Party, when I feel like not quite. It is definitely the liberal wing of the party, the Bernie Sanders types, but you have people within the Democrat Party who aren't quite as... There aren't as many blue dogs as there used to be, but there are still some moderately thinking Democrats.
Yeah, sort of. So here's what's interesting is, and I can't speak for Indiana any longer because I don't follow Indiana politics
very well. It's all red.
Sure. But I mean, in Florida, you still see moderate blue dog Democrats, and you still see sane libertarian-oriented, free-thinking Republicans. But the difference is the Florida House, for example, is 140 members, right? So if you think about a state house seat, it's your county, right?
Yeah.
Maybe even a little smaller than your county. And in Florida, our legislature is part-time. Mm-hmm. And our representatives they have offices in the district, but they all have full-time jobs. They make 30 grand a year, but essentially.
Yeah. Right?
So they all have full-time jobs, with the exception of a couple of Republicans I'm not going to name. They all have regular, normal jobs. They own businesses. They're lawyers. They, you know, I can give you a dozen examples. And so they're much more connected to the constituents and the voters. And, you know, they live in the communities. Their kids go to school here. You know, they know everybody. Like my state representative, Allison Tant, is like remarkably well known here in Leon County. Like I think freaking everybody knows Allison, right? And she's an incredible person. She's the kind of person that, you know, you see her out in the street, she walks in and gives you a hug. You know, she knows who you are. She knows your kids. You know, I can text her anytime I want and say, hey, can I come down and talk to you about something? Sure, come on down tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. At the federal level, none of that happens, right? Yeah. And when you and I got started in this business, the size of the congressional district was population-wise significantly smaller than it is now. Mm-hmm. And so you know, to pick on a certain person just off the top of my head, but Dan Burton was a guy who was around Carmel, right? Yeah. Love mm-hmm. him or hate him, he was around Carmel Fishers, right? I remember that. He was around Lawrence. He was around kind of in the neighborhood. You know, you could run into him or you could get to meet him relatively easy. Julie Carson, same way. Julie Carson,
yeah,
you know this better than I do, was at a freaking family barbecue every damn Saturday of every year. I mean, if there was a barbecue or a corner gathering or something, you know Julie was there.
And it did not matter who you were. She treated you like family. Like she knew
you. She did. 100%. And so, you know, I can't remember exactly the population growth in congressional districts between now and then. But mm-hmm. I know it's been pretty significant. And now a congressional district is so large that your member of Congress, unless you personally know him or her, and know like where he eats and where he goes to church, you're never going to meet him. Like you're yeah. literally never, unless it's a campaign rally or, you know, some, you know, link, if you're going to pay money to go to some stupid Lincoln Day dinner, you're not going to run into your congressman anymore. Whereas mm-hmm. at the state level, and I'm only speaking for Florida because I know this from experience, most of the state representatives are very personable one-on-one people. They don't, you know, for one thing, they have one or two staffers. They don't have 20, right? Yeah. Or 16 or whatever. They have one or two. You know, state senators, I think, have three. I think we have 40 state senate districts. And especially during session, if you're in Tallahassee, it's very easy to go down there and literally walk. Like, I'll give you a great example. A couple of weeks ago, I brought a school group down to the state house. I say state house. It's an old habit I got to break. I say state house here, people look at me like I'm nuts. It's an Indiana habit I've never broken.
What do they call it down there?
It's just the Capitol.
Okay. I see. I hear that.
Our Capitol is a modern skyscraper. Yeah, but our Capitol is a modern skyscraper. It's not an actual like state house looking building.
That's a
discussion.
All right. Okay.
And so, but a couple weeks ago, it was Valentine's Day, actually. I brought a delegation of about 15 high school kids down to the Capitol building. And literally, not only did they sit down and meet with five or six different legislators, they actually wandered the halls of the Capitol and literally just wandered into offices and said hi to members.
Really?
And said hi to staff. Yeah. And everybody's, you know, they're friendly. Of course, it's a group of kids, right? Mm-hmm. Politicians love kids. If you know where you're going and you know you can read signs on the wall, it's pretty easy to kind of, if you want to go meet people and say hi to people, it's very easy to do. It reminds me back in the day in Indiana when you used to be able to go into the upstairs part where they all, the big bullpen area,
yeah,
they all were in there, and you could wander in there pre-9/11. You could wander in there very easily and go find people and go talk to them. It's what I used mm-hmm. to do. You can still do that here. And so because of that, I find legislators here to be far more real and far more representative of their districts than you ever see on the state level.
I think that we had that discussion before because there is, and briefly, there was the, you guys have the controversial Don't Say Gay bill.
You can't be gay in Florida, so that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Great for Miami Beach.
But you actually had a couple of Republicans who voted against that bill.
And
I remember asking you about that, and you said that, well, that's because they're actually representing their district.
Right. Chip LaMarco is the first one that comes to mind. I know there was one or two others, but Chip is the first one that comes to mind, and Chip represents Broward County, which is where I grew up. It's Fort Lauderdale for people who don't know. And there's a significant LGBTQ community in Broward County. And And Chip is also known to be a pretty open-minded, I almost said moderate. I don't know that he's a moderate, but he's certainly a more real, open-minded, you know, pretty decent kind of a guy.
Yeah.
And a guy like that is not going to go back to his constituency and say, hey, I just voted to basically outlaw you guys.
Like, yeah.
It's for people who don't realize just how giant of a state Florida is. I mean, keep in mind, I'm 10 minutes from Georgia, right? It's
yes.
I can walk to Georgia. We have airline, we have significant number of airline flights within the state of Florida. That's how big Florida is. So I can fly I can fly from here to Orlando, Tampa, West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, Fort Myers, Miami, Key West from Tallahassee. Miami's 500 miles away from me. Right. So that's how big the state is. So a lot of that big part of the state for people who like only know Florida from either South Beach or Disney.
Yeah.
You know, an hour away from Disney is cattle farms.
You don't think of cattle when you think of Florida.
No, but we are, I don't know if we're the largest, I know we're the top three agriculture producing states in America. I know California is up there. It's a couple states that are up there. Florida is in the top three or four.
If I recall correctly,
I'm going to get viewer mail. And people are going to go, oh, you're wrong. It's actually fifth or whatever. Cool.
Yeah.
If I'm wrong, tweet me. All right. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure, if memory serves me correctly, we're in the top three.
Well, what I recall about the Florida Agriculture Commissioner position is that is kind of the, that has been seen as kind of a launching point for governor, correct?
It's because it's the large, because it's agriculture and consumer affairs combined. So it is by far the largest state. It's not an agency. It's the largest cabinet position in terms of influence and authority and a number of things that report to you. Like, for example, the agriculture commissioner issues gun permits. The agriculture commissioner is the one who certifies gas pumps.
Like, okay.
I'm just randomly picking things.
Okay. So, states do weird things.
We in Florida, if it's going to be weird, we're going to do it.
So I just got to move it back here a bit. What was the name of the representative from Broward?
Chip LaMarca.
So if he was running for Congress, there's no way he
which he's actually been rumored to be looking at. Ted Deutsch just stepped down today, I believe.
Really?
Ted represents Southern Palm Beach County, kind of Northern Broward County. And so Ted's one of the good guys, kind of Boynton Beach, Delray, people who know geography in South Florida. And so Chip has actually been rumored to be looking at that seat.
That's interesting. I mean, just considering that is not what would be, he would not probably be considered mainstream Republican thinking.
No. No, he wouldn't be, he probably wouldn't be a top recruit by NRCC.
There you go. So, okay, if you had, because we're getting close to an end point here, which honestly for us, this whole conversation will feel extremely truncated. I see the face, I know, we should go on. And if we had done this at the original time, we probably could have. But that was my bad. We're in the midterm year. How do you see the midterms shaking out for the Republicans, for the Democrats, for President Biden? And then the last question after that, what are your predictions for tonight, for the speech tonight?
Republicans are going to take the House by a pretty significant margin. And a group of yahoos is going to try to make Donald Trump Speaker of the House. So that's my prediction. I think in the long run, it's not going to be Kevin McCarthy. So I think that dude's going to get knifed. You heard it here first. He's going to get shipped.
That means it's only going to get worse.
I think the Republicans are going to win the House by a large margin. The Senate. I think there's some seats that are up for grabs that I think people are taking, taking for granted. I think Val Demings has an outside shot against Marco Rubio here in Florida. She has a remarkable story. Went to elementary school in Jacksonville area in a segregated elementary school. Rose from foot patrolman to chief of Orlando Police Department. Is a respected member of Congress. Has an incredible story. Marco is Marco. There's probably not a more self-clowning politician in America than Marco Rubio.
Ted Cruz? The guy left his state.
But at least if someone called Marco's wife ugly, Marco would at least fight back.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Ted Cruz is the bigger.
Yeah, I guess I did just contradict myself, didn't I?
Okay. Yeah, you did.
Yep. You know, State of the Union tonight, listen, I will vote for the next president who promises to return to issuing a written statement for the State of the Union.
Amen, brother.
I hate the whole spectacle. I think the whole thing is garbage. I watched part of one of Trump's for entertainment purposes. I have not really watched the State of the Union. I may have watched one or two of Obama's, but they're just theater. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of Republicans booing and yelling and throwing tantrums and, you know, doing some kind of performance art on the floor. Every Democrat is giving him repeated standing ovations. We already know how this works.
Yep.
You know, Biden isn't the greatest speech giver in the world. I think that's being kind. But I don't really care. I think he's a genuine, decent, honest human being. I don't agree with a lot of decisions that he's made. I would think twice about voting for him in 2 years, although if it's against Ron DeSantis, I'll vote for him happily. Mm-hmm. But I think tonight's State of the Union is mostly going to be about Ukraine, as it should be. I'm sure he's going to talk about number of jobs created, which, in fairness, it's easy to have a massive economic recovery when your predecessor kills the entire economy because he thinks fish tank cleaner kills COVID. Or ejecting bleach or whatever, you know, whatever new fad that he had. I mean, if Trump had mismanaged COVID so remarkably poorly, not only would he have been reelected, but there wouldn't have been a cratered economy to recover from in the first place. So, you know, it's kind of like when your house burns down and you're like, oh, we just, you know, you're rebuilding the house and you build a room. Like, oh, look. You know, this is the biggest the house has been in the last 2 years. Well, yes, because the house burned down. You're starting from scratch. Like, it's easy to have great job numbers when, like, everybody's unemployed. And then suddenly, you know, it's kind of like FDR in World War II. And he went from, like, 40% unemployment to, like, 0% unemployment. Well, yeah, well, because we're in a war, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but listen, you take the victory in politics, you take the wins as they come, right?
Yeah.
So it's a win. He should take the win. He shouldn't gloat on it too much. He should remember that, you know, 900 some odd thousand Americans are dead. Thanks primarily to his predecessor, and kind of focus on that as well. But also keep in mind that people are back to work, man. Every place I go, they're short staffed. There's signs on the window, you know, please be patient. We're short staffed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, anybody who literally can hold a job can have a job right now.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said for
them. Speaking of someone who's holding a job, at some point I'm going to have you back on so we can talk about the great disappearing act of Kamala Harris. Because
not my favorite vice president.
A mutual acquaintance of ours sent me a tweet of her trying to explain the situation in Ukraine. And it truly was one of those.
It was terrible.
It honestly was. And it was at the beginning of an interview. And I think what she was trying to do was explain it to someone who as if no one knew where Russia was or where Ukraine was or what was going on there. And honestly, most people's foreign policy knowledge in this country is less than the kindergartner's level.
100%.
So if you come into that with that perspective, it still sounds pretty bad. And it was cut off. So it's also like, okay, so we have like sampled audio. We don't have the context, but again, just that little bit. And I was just like, okay, it's like you're talking to a three-year-old. That doesn't come across well at all. But I feel like we're gonna have to talk about the great disappearing act of Kamala Harris, because she had all the hype and the buzz coming out of the 2020 election. And now it's just like, where is she? And when I think of Obama and Biden, they were so buddy-buddy that, you know, you half expected that Biden-Harris to be buddy-buddy. It's like, I don't think they see each other hardly at all.
No, but the difference was Joe Biden was an eminently qualified and competent vice president.
Well, there is that.
No one really is quite sure how Kamala Harris is qualified to be vice president.
I was buying into it during the election, but now that she's there, I half the time wonder how she even became Attorney General of California.
And you might be the first one to ask that question.
Yeah. Well, okay. So on that note, this has been a great, it's almost a bit of a recap, but not, it's just good to be with you again, Jacob. It's good to talk politics. We'll be focusing more on issues. I do want to have you on so that we can just like get down into the nitty gritty of an issue. And that's how we're going to be focusing on season two, but it's good to get kind of kick things off with, you know, kind of a relaxed feel and just kind of head on into this season. So Jacob, where are you most socially active where people can either be laughing or offended by you?
You're more likely to be offended.
Yes,
but I am.
That's what I want.
I am at Real Jacob Perry on Twitter. Although I try to be behaved because half of my son's high school basketball teammates follow me on Twitter.
Oh no, they're finding you out.
They make fun of me at practice. They'll come up and say to me, "So what is Real Jacob Perry think about, you know, this or that or whatever?" It's pretty funny. So I have to be a little more aware of it. Twitter was a lot easier when like nobody actually knew who you were.
Yeah.
But, like now that I am, you know, like I'll go down to the Capitol and a representative will say to me, "Oh, I love that tweet that you sent last week." Or, you know, mm-hmm. I was at my son's school last week and the principal said to me, "Man, you sent out a tweet the other day that really cracked me up." And I was kind of like a little awkward. It's like,
yeah, like,
man, I hope it wasn't really stupid.
Thank you, I guess. I do have one question, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, because I think you were filling a void that I had created when I stopped doing Political Nomad for a while by doing your Monticello newsletter and your Monticello Live. But it's been a while since that's happened. Is there any chance that we see the return of Monticello Live or the newsletter?
Because
that was good stuff.
I have like a dozen drafts actually saved in the Substack folder.
Oh, nice.
As you know privately, that I am engaged in a project that I can't announce.
Yes, I think we might be
doing pretty soon. And that has absorbed an exceptional amount of creative energy.
Gotcha. Yes.
You know, normally devoted to that. And so I'm just on a quick hiatus, but we are coming back.
Awesome. That sounds great. Well, okay. That's going to do it for this episode. The first episode of season two, my guest has been Jacob Perry. Find him at Real Jacob Perry on Twitter. You will be offended and you will laugh. It's a riot. His son's friends think so. Thank you so much for being on, Jacob. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Appreciate it. Cheers.
Cheers.